Meeting will be in order. We appreciate you all coming over. One thing before we really get started, we were a little bit concerned that OMB refused to clear some slides addressing some additional information that we requested. And I think the information that we requested was certainly not a jeopardy of national security or anything like that. And maybe at some time you can address kind of what the problem is that perhaps I guess we would be concerned that if we felt that you believe that we didn't really have the right to have the information about how employees spend their time, or that we don't need to know the status of the information technology programs which we are requesting, for which you are requesting funding. So we'll talk about that in a little bit. But we appreciate having you here. Today we'll hear from Mr. Ron Ament, Director Under Secretary for Benefits, regarding the President's budget proposal for VA voc rehab and employment, education, and loan guarantee programs. Mr. Ament, am I saying that right?
Yes, you are, sir.
Good. I'm Bozeman, but answer to Boozman and whatever. Mr. Ament is accompanied by program directors Ms. Judy Caden, Mr. Keith Pettigo, Mr. Dennis Douglas, and Mr. Scott Denniston from the Office of Small and Disadvantaged Business Utilization. Mr. Denniston does not work for VBA, but we have jurisdiction over a veteran-owned small business, and so we thought it important to have him here. We will also receive testimony from the DAV representing the Independent Budget and the American Legion. We have asked the Vietnam Veterans of America to submit their views for the record, and without objection, their submission will be made part of the record. I thank each of you for coming today. As I said at the full committee hearing last week, I am pleased that the President has significantly increased the overall budget for VA. However, it is no secret that VBA faces serious problems in delivering timely services to its voc rehab and education beneficiaries. I note that for the week ending 28th of January, the Education Service had a backlog of about 110,000 claims, or about the same as last year, and that processing days are up. Voc rehab is over 6,400 in application status. Loan guarantee seems to be chugging along. But we absolutely must do a better job getting the GI Bill checks to veterans and getting the veterans through the evaluation and testing period so that they can get on with their rehab. I want to hear some ideas from the Department and VSOs to make these programs run smoother. I'm also concerned about the significant disparity in performance among the various regional offices. For example, the San Diego regional office takes about 18 days to determine whether a veteran is eligible for voc rehab. Unfortunately, the Washington regional office takes over 180 days. Now, I know that certainly some variation is inevitable, but a factor of 10 is totally out of line. The entire system averages about 62 days to determine entitlement. So I guess any way that we look at it, something's wrong and needs to be fixed. I have to believe that staffing levels play a role in this. Therefore, I request VA to provide the subcommittee with an analysis of the disparity between the best and worst performers in making timely voc rehab entitlement decisions, including the number of voc rehab staff by position for each RO. Mr. Allman, if you would, please provide us with a date when that information would be available to the subcommittee. I'm sure all of you know that Chairman Bouyer has expressed his support for modernizing the GI Bill, and I want to again state my enthusiastic support for that initiative. I look forward to working with Ms. Herseth and her staff to craft a bill that will reflect how today's military operates. I now recognize our ranking member, Ms. Herseth.
Well, good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm very pleased to be here today to examine the President's fiscal year 2007 budget request as it relates to VA programs that fall within the jurisdiction of the Economic Opportunity Subcommittee. For many years, education benefits, vocational rehabilitation services, and VA home loans have been a hallmark for the types of services a grateful nation provides to the men and women who serve and sacrifice in defense of the country. These earned benefits are critical to service members, veterans, and their families as they attempt to successfully transition from military service to civilian life. I'm particularly interested in hearing about the VA's efforts to address the growing education claims workload, as the Chairman mentioned, the progress in implementing the 2003 VRNE Task Force report, including any special efforts to reach out to rural areas, and the Loan Guarantee Services consolidation efforts while maintaining high-quality service to veterans and thorough oversight over property management contractors. In recent years, much progress has been made in these programs. However, I think we can all agree that we must remain vigilant to maintain against any decline in top-quality benefits and customer service. So, Mr. Chairman, I look forward to hearing from the witnesses today and want to thank you for holding the hearing.
Thank you very much. Let's begin with the first panel. The Honorable Ron Ahmet is Deputy Undersecretary for Benefits. Ms. Judy Caden is the Director of the Volk Rehab and Employment Service. Mr. Keith Pedigo is Director of the Loan Guarantee Service, and Mr. Dennis Douglas, Acting Director of the Education Service, and Mr. Scott Denniston for the Office of Small and Disadvantaged Business. Before Mr. Ahmet begins, I think that we need to note that the Education Service Director position has been vacant for 7 months, and certainly, this is certainly not any reflection anyway on the excellent job that Mr. Douglas has done as Acting Director, but I think it is time that we need to fill that job one way or the other. Leadership continuity is important, and lengthy gaps are not a good way to run, certainly a very important program. As a matter of fact, one can infer from such gaps that directors do not have significant impact on the day operations, and that should not be the case. So, again, I guess what I'm trying to do is say that we appreciate Mr. Douglas's good work, and I guess we would lend support, to going ahead and getting, things finalized one way or the other. Now, in a second, Mr. Ahmet, we want you to start, and really what I'd like to do today is I know you're going to give a presentation, and so I'd like to break a little bit in the sense with our normal way of doing things, and really, Ms. Herseth, whoever is here at during the day, I'd like for them to feel free to kind of break in as you go through and just feel free, Ms. Herseth, if something comes up that we don't understand, to ask a question then rather than the formal presentation and to come back. But I think that we'd really, the purpose of this hearing is to really, be a good educational, situation so that we can better understand what's going on. And I think that'll be a little bit easier, if that's okay with you all.
We would welcome that approach, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
Well, thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Congresswoman Herseth, appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today to discuss VA's 2007 budget request for the education, vocational rehabilitation and employment, and loan guarantee programs. My testimony will highlight VA's commitments to meeting the needs of our nation's veterans and key initiatives that are included in the 2007 budget request for these three programs. The programs I'll discuss today assist service members in making a transition from military to civilian life and provide vital economic opportunities that allow veterans and their families to prosper. We help veterans and their dependents seek greater education and economic opportunities through the highly successful Montgomery GI Bill program and other educational programs. We promote homeownership through the Loan Guarantee Program for qualifying veterans with disabilities. Our Vocational Rehabilitation and Employment Program provides both rehabilitation and training and assists them in reentering the civilian workforce. We're proud of these programs and appreciate your interest in them. We're pleased with the 2007 budget request for each of these programs. The funding levels for education and VR&E support significant increases in staffing, which will allow us to address the growing workload. Although the loan guarantee staffing levels will be reduced slightly, the numbers are sufficient in light of the program's continued operational improvements. The budget also includes funding for official initiatives that will ensure we have a trained and skilled workforce with access to systems and tools that support service delivery. VA's budget will allow these programs to improve overall performance and to continue to fulfill our mission of delivering benefits and services in a responsive, timely, and compassionate manner in recognition of veteran service to their nation. With that, I would like to transition to some of the slides that we're going to be using to help step ourselves through the budget request for these three programs, if I could, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Let me ask one thing real quick is in regard to your statement. When responding to a question regarding a decrease in CMP FTE before the full committee last week, Undersecretary Cooper said he would look at moving the proposed additions around. Is that still the VBA position? If so, what will be the effect on the business lines that we're going to be discussing today?
I understand that there was some concern when Admiral Cooper provided that response in the overall full committee hearing. I do believe he was largely referring to moving some of the FTE around within the three programs that make up the compensation and pension business line. In particular, he was referring to compensation program, pension program, and the burial program. I think if you look at that carefully, you'll see that while there was some decrease in the FTE, direct FTE supporting the compensation business line, there was also a corresponding increase in the pension business line. So it would be our expectation that any type of changes in budget execution would be largely within those three particular business lines. Clearly, the workload and workload conditions would, as we approach the actual budget year, would dictate final decisions. But I do believe that was what he had in mind largely when he made that statement.
Thank you.
First slide, Lisa. The format that we're going to be proposing to use today as we go through each of the three programs would be pretty much similar in nature. We'll be looking at the programs, program highlights within each of the three respective programs, focusing on program highlights, workload, performance, and initiatives. Please. I'd like to begin with the education program. For the top line, you can see the total obligations that have been estimated for these programs, 2005 actuals of $84 million, rising to $88 million in the current year, 2006, and rising again to $92.3 million for the budget year 2007. Those will support a growing staffing level in the education program. Which for staffing purposes, we divide the staffing into direct staffing and indirect staffing. Indirect staffing consists of a variety of management and overhead staff that are pretty much by budget allocated across the basis that goes tracks against the budget and overall staffing levels. It's roughly around 14% of our staffing level is allocated to management and oversight. That also includes information technology. The information technology, as I'm sure you're aware, Mr. Chairman, that's a little bit of an unknown today because we're in the process now of moving towards this so-called federated model, in which the information technology staff are going to be divided into operations and maintenance staff and development staff. The way the model is foreseen is that the operations and maintenance staff would be transferring out of the administrations and into the under the direct control of the department CIO. So there will be some staffing adjustment as we actually move towards implementing the that model within the department. The budgets that you look at for the dollars for 06 and 07, both years, already reflect the movement of some of the non-payroll money all of the non-payroll dollars have been moved out of the administration's appropriation accounts and into that of the CIO. So it's very difficult in some cases on a dollar-for-dollar basis trying to compare 05 to 06 and 07.
Out of the – with the additional 46 FTE, how many direct service folks are going to come out of that number?
The take a look at my
education
notes on that one.
Education service staff.
But I believe we've got for 04, we've got, I believe Do you know what the number is on that? 34 FTE.
Okay, good. We have been joined by Mr. Evans, the ranking member on the full subcommittee, and do you have anything that you'd like to open with Mr. Evans?
Just wanted to measure your judgment on the record and look forward to working with you on this work that we have been working hard to obtain. We're going to make sure we get the best possible veterans again with their budget. And I just go back my time with the complete record. If that could be put in place of the record, we'd appreciate it, Mr. Chairman.
Without objection, and we appreciate having you here. Appreciate your hard work on behalf of veterans. Do you all have any questions about this particular slide? Or?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Can we move on to the next slide? Discuss briefly the workload for the estimate and for the in the upcoming budget year for the education program. As you can see, first of all, that there has been some very, very heavy increases in workload that took place between the years 2000 and 2005. We believe that in part that reflects the improvements in the benefits program for the education program. The increases recently in the Montgomery GI Bill program that took place a couple of years ago, we believe, are largely responsible for the increase in workload. Going into the budget year 2007, we do not foresee the same level of increase that we've experienced in years past, because we do believe that there is some leveling of that change that went along with the benefits improvement. Nonetheless, though, as we continue to have more service members making a transition from military to civilian status, we continue to see high usage of the educational benefits. We also expect to see growing use of the new Chapter 1607 benefit that we applaud. We believe that this is a vast improvement in the benefits that are made available to guardsmen and reservists, really reflecting the different role that they've been asked to play in support of our nation. But again, we do expect to see additional workload increases associated with that program.
If I might interject here, because I was going to ask if the VA had a position about the effectiveness of the new benefit for the guardsmen and reserves under Chapter 1607, and it sounds to me like you feel that it is a good program as it's been implemented thus far, very effective in meeting some of the unique needs. Can you tell me of the pending education claims of, I believe, just over 100,000, do you know how many come under Chapter 1607?
We believe that we probably have around 12,000 of those claims pending. It was really only in December of 2005 where we actually completed the arrangements necessary with DOD to allow us to begin making payments under Chapter 1607. That we actually began making some payments very late in the month in December, and we've been making them strictly on a manual basis while we've been waiting to stand up our automated payment system. That will be installed this weekend, this coming weekend, and it is our expectation that we should quickly work through the backlog of those claims. And Dennis tells me 3 to 4 weeks. I'm confident we can do it in 2 to 3 weeks on this. Mm-hmm.
I'm pleased to hear that, and so may just one more question to interject as it relates to this slide.
Yep.
And you may not have been finished with the summary of what you wanted to provide in testimony, which we certainly want you to go back to. But in addition to the increases in the FTEs, and I'm glad that your response to Chairman Bozeman's question about Admiral Cooper's testimony and how the increases in the FTEs in certain areas hopefully won't be juggled in a way that minimizes what we hope to accomplish with that increase, both in the education service and within VR&E. But do you have, in addition to the increase in the FTEs as well as the automated payment system for the new program and perhaps improvements in the payments made to other education service programs, what else, what is the rest of the strategy to deal with the pending claims that are? Are there any other aspects of that strategy you could describe to us today?
Well, we believe probably certainly the quickest way to actually tackle the backlog, the existing backlog, is through employment, by adding new staffing resources to the program. Within the education program, we believe that, as distinguished from the compensation pension business line, we can typically make a new hire productive in a 6 to 9 month time frame. so that new staffing resources coming to this program have a really measurable effect relatively quickly in comparison to the compensation and pension business line. For some more midterm initiatives, technology typically is a longer-term solution and takes some time to actually bring from concept to fielding and actual application in production. But in the meantime, you will note that in our budget it contains some employee certification work that we plan to apply to the education program. We think that this can help ensure a certain level of professionalism, amongst our workforce. And in addition, we're continuing to invest in training and training tools in support of the educational program.
On the slide, increases as a result of enhanced outreach. What would be an example of that, just out of curiosity? What are we doing in that regard?
Largely, I'll turn to Dennis. There's a couple of strategies for outreach. There is a direct contact strategy where these are included in many of the transitional type briefings that we provide to transitioning service members. Last year, we conducted nearly 8,200 separate briefings and briefed over 325,000 transitioning service members, including members of the Guard and Reserve. And Dennis step in here, but we also have some direct mailings that are provided to transitioning service members both before they leave the service and shortly after departing the service as well.
Yes, sir. About 12 months after an individual comes on active duty. About 12 months after an individual comes on active duty, they actually receive the first of a series of mailings from VA in partnership with DOD through the Defense Manpower Data Center. It basically is an introduction to the Montgomery GI Bill, which the service member has agreed to participate in by having his pay reduced. At the 24-month period, we also send another mailing, again, merely reminding him or her that they have an important benefit that can be used. Strictly speaking, can be used at that 24-month period while they're still on active duty. It tends not to happen that way, of course. It tends to wait until they've been released from service. Then again, about 6 to 9 months before they're scheduled to separate, we have another mailing that has a little more detailed brochure, gives them a lot more information on eligibility requirements, things they need to know to be prepared for that transitioning period. We know that many of them will not seek education right away, but we want that information to be in their hands as they transition so that they can make those important decisions. After separation, about 90 days to 6 months afterwards, they get another mail out with veteran status that basically reiterates all of those things that we've said up to that point.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Ms. Brown-White has joined us. Do you have an opening statement or anything you'd like to?
Mr. Chairman, I do. First of all, I certainly want to thank you for holding this committee hearing today. And it's very timely. As you know, I have the most number of veterans of any member of Congress. And I like to believe that they moved into the district because I fight so hard for veterans and for their needs. We have a great opportunity here with thousands of soldiers returning from Iraq. And I just got back from a visit to Iraq last week, Iraq and Afghanistan, the members of the military returning back from, and also other parts of the world. And so I believe that it's essential that Congress assist them in making the transition from the front lines to the home front. There is no doubt that the VA will seek a surge we'll see a surge in the number of individuals seeking assistance in education, vocation, and home loans. Given this increased workload, I believe it is essential that we need to continue to direct funds and resources to the area of need while also bringing greater efficiency and better use of our resources. I look forward to hearing the information today, and I apologize for being late. I had some folks visiting from Florida. Once again, I certainly want to thank the Secretary for being here today and look forward to the continuation of the comments. I do have a question later, but I think I'll let you go through some of the rest of the presentation.
Very good. Thank you. Again, the way that we're doing this is the slides come up. If you have a question at that time, feel free to. This is going to be very informal from that respect and a little bit different than perhaps how we normally do our hearings. So, Mr. Ahmet.
May I move on to the next slide, Mr. Chairman? this will briefly provide you some of the performance statistics that we consider most critical for the educational program. The average days to complete our original claims for 2005 was 33 days. We predict this going down, estimate it going down by the end of 2006 to an average of 27 days. And with the resources requested in the 2007 budget, we believe we can bring that down to 25 days. Currently, we're running at around 39 days for the year to date. The educational program is a cyclical program. Typically we will see spikes in the timeliness based upon the peak periods of educational enrollment. But we believe that as we bring more staff on, make those staff more productive, we'll be able to bring that down to an average of 27 days by the end of the year. Our supplemental claims we ended the year 2005 with an average of 19 days. We expect to be able to bring that down to 13 days in 2006 and to 12 days in 2007.
I'm sorry. Now, on the chart, we've got targets and things. And I think I'm not sure if you answered this or not, but what are the for real, the current performance?
I think I mentioned that today, as of the end of January. The original claim timeliness was running at 39 days.
39 days.
Yes. Okay. Dennis, how about supplementals?
21.9 days for supplemental claims through the end of month of January.
As we mentioned, that's clearly not what we're hoping for, but we, as mentioned, we do have a cycle in the educational claims processing that typically this is the high point of the year.
How would that compare to a year ago with the, not the target, but the actual, what was going on a year ago? I'm just trying to figure out if we're moving in the right direction.
Right. Okay, 36.6
a year ago. And 19.8 for supplementals.
And what would you say again as far as the you mentioned the outreach efforts, which I think are great, all of the things that you're doing to try and get people aware of their benefit, that's so important. How would we compare the number of interactions this year with, we're talking about time delays now, but how would we compare, what's the usage now compared to a year ago? Do we have any figures along that line?
Let me clarify the question, Mr. Chairman. You say the usage figures for the educational benefit or our outreach figures?
Well, again, it looks like we've lost a few days. What I'm trying to do is figure out, is that due to the fact that we've got more people trying to access the benefit now than we did a year ago?
Dennis?
Through the end of the first quarter, we're about on pace with where we were at the end of the first quarter last year. I think the reason that we're seeing the slight bump up in timeliness is because during October, November, and December, not only is that generally our highest point, but with additional staff that we got last year, we worked down some of the older cases. Those older cases will be reflected in a higher average processing time until they're worked through the system. I believe you'll see significant declines or improvements in the timeliness through the rest of the year because we moved a large number of those older cases out of the system.
So the next peak period is going to be June, July, August? getting ready for September enrollment?
Actually, we'll see probably a very small spike in the April-May timeframe, but for spring and summer enrollments. And then it'll be very small, and then in the fall, September, October, we will see another peak period. I would expect that peak, however, not to be as daunting as the last fall enrollment was, because we will have had more staff and more proficient staff by that point in time.
Go ahead.
If I could add, much of last year, 2005, we were on a somewhat of a hiring freeze in most of our major programs. We were 2006, it's turned out, with the help of the Congress and of the department, a much better year than we were predicting this time last year. And that, as such, we really had pretty tight hiring controls on throughout the year. And it was really not until the summer that we gave the Education Service license to go out and hire. Now, with the additional resources this year, we've increased their staffing levels yet again. And probably more importantly for the directors at our regional processing offices, we've given them a ceiling that they can continue to hire against. So that, as opposed to waiting for permission from headquarters to go out and hire, they've been given authority to maintain constant staffing levels throughout the year, so that as they have people coming off the rolls, they can quickly backfill those individuals. So,
I appreciate the kind of recapping where we were last year at this time, because I remember specifically stating the concern to Admiral Cooper, because we had this new program for Guard and Reserves, and there was, I think, a reduction in FTEs at this time last year that was proposed, and we expressed concern about that. So I do hope that Mr. Douglas and Mr. Ament, that the trend of the numbers at this stage is reflected in part because of the older cases that we're working down, but perhaps you could provide to the subcommittee a comparison from last year to this year in that April and May timeframe, as well as the other spike that we anticipate seeing in the fall, just so we'd give us a little bit of assurance there.
We'll be happy to do that.
Thanks.
Ms. Brownlight.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question for the Secretary. Back in, I think it is November, there was an article in the Miami Herald about the backlog of those some 8,000 who have applied for the new funding under Chapter 1607. And I also had a constituent contact me. Where are you in working on that number of backlogged applications? I actually had a constituent who virtually was in the, at the edge of bankruptcy, because he had proceeded, enrolled in college, and just obviously did not have that money. Where are you in working on that backlog? And you may have already covered it, and I apologize if you did.
No, I'll be happy to provide that, Congresswoman. It was not until mid-December that we actually were in a position where we could actually legally make any payments whatsoever. We had to, on December 15th, we signed the Memorandum of Understanding with the Department of Defense that actually positioned us to begin making some payments on this new benefit. By the end of the month of December, we had made some payments. We're making payments strictly on a manual basis while we've been waiting to stand up the automated payment system needed to process those claims on a routine basis. As of today, we have around 12,000 Chapter 1607 payments that are pending. We've made payments on just something under 1,000. We expect over this weekend, we have a scheduled system install that will allow us to bring up the new payment system for Chapter 1607 payments, and we expect to be able to work down the backlog in its entirety in 3 to 4 weeks.
If I may follow up, have you been in touch with the veterans to let them know what the problem is, or has it just been if they contact you?
It's largely been if they would contact us. As far as the individual veterans, the 12,000 veterans, we've not been doing any targeted outreach that I'm aware of.
Could you turn your microphone on?
I'm sorry. Yes. Thank you. When the reservists filed their first claims with the VA, we made an initial contact with them basically to let them know that, number one, we had their claim, number two, that we were awaiting
some of the legal issues that Mr. Ahmet mentioned, and three, as soon as those things were cleared, we would begin making the payments. We did not contact them routinely after that unless they contacted us.
Thank you. And will you report back to the committee that when this weekend is over so that we know that people are being taken care of properly? Mr. Chairman, if you would indulge me, I think that would be very appropriate. Every member of Congress has people in that catchment group who are concerned.
We'll be happy to do that. May I move on to the next slide?
Yes, sir.
Education initiatives. I believe I'd already mentioned the first initiative, the skills certification. This was an initiative that we began in the compensation and pension business line that we believe is very, very important, and that you know, helps us ensure a certain level of professionalism. We believe in the staff that needs to be that we need to have some sort of confidence that they've attained this level of professionalism. We are going to be investing in the educational program for skills certification for the for staff, the claims processing staff within the educational business line in the 2007 budget. The second initiative is one that I regret that I'm not able to provide greater information that you'd requested on, but the Information Technology Initiative that we call TEAS began as the Education Expert System. This is an umbrella program that currently we have funding for in 2006 and 2007 to take on a limited component of the overall program as it's been envisioned. As fully envisioned, we would be in trying to incorporate more rules-based processing into the educational program that we believe holds great potential for efficiencies in this program, not only efficiencies, but qualitative improvements in the form of accuracy of payments as well. There are three applications within the education business line that we have funding to proceed with for years 2006 and 2007. And the program is currently envisioned, would include fielding each of those three applications before the end of fiscal 2007. I could state two other initiatives in the information technology area that that we're looking at for the education program. I believe that Chairman Booyer in the full hearing commission was talking about the issues of funding for code conversion. This is our departmental CIO is very interested in this program. And this would be an initiative to expedite our exit off of some of the department legacy systems into a more modern corporate processing environment that ideally would position us to make quicker improvements to the program supporting applications and by positioning us in a more modern information technology environment. We're looking at a proof of concept a program that we would like to be able to undertake this year that, if successful, would provide us for a pathway to apply to those systems that remain on our legacy, under legacy systems, the benefits delivery network that you may have heard of, the BDN network. The program that has the largest number of programs that continue to reside in that environment without an exit strategy is our education programs. So that if the code conversion, a proof of concept proves successful, we're very optimistic that that will help expedite our exit strategy from the legacy systems. The other component that we're looking at this year about undertaking some work on in the current budget year is what we call the TIMS, which is the image management system that supports the educational programs. Currently, the infrastructure for TIMS are there are separate imaging systems and databases that are in place at each of our four regional processing offices. The investment that we're looking at in this current year would help move those into a single database that would enable us to move work around more freely among our regional processing offices, so that, you know, as any type of regional backlog would develop, we'd be able to redistribute some of the workload to try and balance the workloads amongst those four offices.
Very good. Before we move out of the education, the Partnership for Veterans Ed has proposed the Total Force GI Bill concept, which Chairman Booyer, I think all of the committee is very interested in looking at. I guess, you know, have you all looked at the proposal and had any discussions with DOD in regard to that, the concept? And I guess what we'd like to know are, besides funding, what other big issues do you see kind of lurking out there in that regard?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We've, as you're aware, that proposal first originated from within the Secretary's Advisory Committee on Education, and that we have looked at that. We have actually taken this proposal to the Joint Executive Council forms the deliberating body between the Department of Veterans Affairs and Department of Defense. We've had some presentations before that body. They've taken it on as a work group to try and help develop the concept. There's going to be a lot of challenging issues to it in addition to the funding, and I'm going to ask Dennis to expand upon those somewhat, but one of the challenge that's one of the more formidable challenges on this is the fact that that envisions all of the applicable law being moved into Title 38. And as you're aware, some of the programs today are under are in Title 10 under the jurisdiction of the Department of Defense. So that does propose some legislative challenges towards actually affecting that. But there are also other types of challenges too in trying to sort of normalize some of those programs, where the Chapter 30 involves a service member contribution. Whereas the other programs do not involve contributions from the reservists. So we have to figure out some of the steps that would be used to try and bring those into conformity as we went to move forward. We do believe that it's very promising, and we're pursuing this in all sincerity on that. But Dennis, maybe you can speak to some of the other challenges involved there.
Thank you. I believe the working group in their early deliberations, and they have met five times since the middle of October, and in fact are scheduled to meet again next week, next Thursday. But probably the single most daunting challenge is the question, can three separate programs with three distinct purposes serving three often separate but sometimes similar populations be seamlessly melded into a single program? And that's probably been the single largest challenge for the group to work on. Another one, and probably related somewhat to that, is should a single program offer all of the best features of any one of those other programs? And I'll give you one example. Several years ago, I guess about 3 years ago, Congress enacted what we call buy-up, where a service member has an opportunity to actually increase his pay reduction by up to $600, and in return get up to $150 a month added on to his basic benefit. Now, that is only available under the Montgomery GI Bill Active Duty Program, and so you raise the question, should that be in a single program that serves all of those constituencies? Those are really the two largest issues. We've talked about other smaller issues, but those seem to be the two biggest ones, other than where does the funding come from and what will a program like this actually cost. And we haven't even gotten into those cost estimates yet.
Okay. Can we move on to the VR&E program? I'd like to touch on some of the program highlights as we had done with education. As you can see, the total obligations are predicted to rise from the 2005 actuals of $133.5 million to $138.8 million in 2006 and $149.3 million in 2007. We're also anticipating some significant staffing increases, particularly in 2007, when the overall staffing level is going to be rising by around 130 FTE between both direct and indirect staffing. The positions that we envision that will be added during 2007 fall into three separate categories. It would be the largest number of them we expect will be in the new employment counselor position that's associated with with the new five-track model to employment. The second most prevalent category would be in counselors. And lastly, we would be adding additional contract specialists to manage the administrative contract work of the VR&E program. During 2005, this program spends quite a bit on contract dollars. We spent over $26 million in 2005 on various contracts. And in some cases, most of those are services, of course, and we employ a number of contract counselors, and some of our offices utilize that authority more than others. But then there are also additional support services that we purchase and, support the vocational rehabilitation programs of the individual enrollees.
How many rehab counselors do you think would be hired out of the 130 FTE?
We would probably be able to give you a better number as we approach the execution cycle. As we said before, the largest number of FTE we envision in this hire would be in the employment counselor position on that, and that, again, is in support of the five-track model. Next slide. Workload. We are predicting in 2005 a 2.75% increase in the workload to just over 100,000 participants, and we're predicting another 2.5% increase in 2007, bringing the total to over 102,000 participants. I believe that it almost goes without saying that some of the factors driving the workload, outreach. As you're aware, that we have individual station that each of our of the MTFs, where most of the returning service members, are first go for the more seriously injured for treatment. We believe that's been very successful in drawing new individuals into the program. For those of you who had watched 60 Minutes over the weekend, there was two very compelling stories there, two young women that were pursuing. There was one with a traumatic brain injury out of the state of Ohio, whose her aspirations are to become a social worker. The other was an amputee who has lost one leg at the hip, who hopes to become a prosthetics, enter into that entire business line. I'm pleased to say that both those individuals are participating in the VR&E program, and it really makes you feel good to be able to have programs that help those types of individuals. And of course, that brings us to the issue that we do have more seriously injured veterans because of the actions going on today on the war against terrorism. So that is contributing to the expected workload increase in the VR&E program.
If I might at this point, just I did see the 60 Minutes segment. I was very heartened by it, of course, and even asked a member of my staff to get a hold of Jessica, who is the young woman who suffered from the traumatic brain injury, because we have a National Guardsman who is receiving care in the same facility that she did in Minneapolis, and want to follow up with her on just, I mean, I think she was given a 2% chance, and she was one of the most articulate individuals I've seen interviewed for a long time. And I do have a question, though, about the follow-up. I mean, I'm glad to know that there's this clear attempt to reach early those veterans who are severely disabled in their service. And I don't know if you have sort of examples from the folks that were interviewed in that segment, but what is the follow-up once they are back in their communities, back with their families, especially in my part of the world, how are we getting to some of the folks that may be in more rural, more sparsely populated areas where the difficulty of travel, or at least the infrequency of travel to say, a Sioux Falls, South Dakota, or to a Minneapolis, Minnesota, poses a particular challenge?
Well, that's a very good question. I'd like to ask Judy Caden in a moment to follow up on that. But I do know that, once we had really initiated the Seamless Transition Initiative, and we were making a better organizational effort to make sure that we had both VBA and VHA staff stationed at the major MTFs. Admiral Cooper made a very strong statement to all of our regional office directors, and that it's been our goal to try and track these most seriously injured service members as they leave the major MTFs and make a transition to their communities. And that it's, we are making every effort to try and follow those individuals into the community. And Admiral Cooper has charged each of our regional office directors that when we become aware that one of these seriously injured service members is now returning back to their community, our regional office directors are expected to call them immediately. Because we realize that not all of these individuals are actually ready for VR&E services. While they're at these facilities, and people need some time to really come to grips with the change in their lives, and that so it's our expectation that we do retain that type of contact, whether it's in a urban or in a rural environment. But Judy, maybe you can add to that.
I'll add one thing to that part of it. We did put a requirement that when that contact is made with a potential VR&E participant, that if they don't express interest in the program at that time, because they're still going through their medical rehab and they're not ready, that within a year we have required the regional offices to go back again to the person. At that point they're at home. Hopefully they've made it through the medical part of their rehab or it's not as intense, and to again talk to them about the VR&E program and try and draw them into it. We also, we have the 57 regional offices with the VR&E staff, and we have about 120 outbase sites also, because we do require a face-to-face with the veteran, and we also use a lot of contract counselors, which would help us in the rural areas especially.
I appreciate the information. Just one suggestion, and perhaps it's being done at some of the regional offices, is if there's that requirement for an additional contact within the year, to certainly try to bring in some of those service members who have participated, have decided to participate in the VR&E program, to make a more sort of peer-to-peer contact about the benefits of the program.
And we'll look at that. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just have another question that's kind of, again, is related to the workload. When you look at the San Diego office, as far as determining entitlement benefit, the range there is 25 days or so. Pittsburgh, 183 days. 18 days in San Diego, 25 in Pittsburgh, 183 days in Washington Regional Office. The data seems to indicate that perhaps the resources aren't being spread, evenly to kind of balance that out. The IB suggests giving the VBA program directors line authority over the VA field office directors. I'd like to know what you think about that. When we see those discrepancies, you kind of wonder what the deal is, and what is the solution to the problem.
First of all, sometimes the numbers don't really tell the whole story, just on face value. The Washington Regional Office, for example, I believe is an exception. As you may be aware, one of the missions of the Washington Regional Office had always been to process all of VBA's foreign work, and that applied to compensation and pension claims as well as VR&E claims as well. We've moved the compensation and pension workload, that has been reassigned out of the Washington Regional Office to our Pittsburgh office, but they still retain the responsibility for managing all of the foreign work out of that office. And that poses a lot of unusual challenges. So I don't know that the Washington Regional Office is probably the best example when you're trying to make those one-to-one comparisons of on a performance basis.
Okay, well, we got, you know, Lincoln, Nebraska is 144 days. So.
Right. And, but I'm going on to say then, as the next one, we do realize that there are some disparities in staffing. VR&E, as I mentioned earlier, with the education workload, had been challenged over the past year or two with some hiring ceilings. I don't agree that I believe that the solution to this is having a sort of a stovepipe arrangement from the program office down to the field. Our VR&E program directors, as does the education program director and loan guarantee program directors, have considerable input into staffing issues and staffing decisions. But I do believe that there is a real benefit in having a local director to be held accountable for the success of a program. I believe that by having that type of a stovepipe arrangement where you have five separate stovepipes going out to the field, it creates a situation where you've got a director who's sort of a building manager that has little or no accountability for the success of those programs and has no ability to make any type of local decisions based upon local workload requirements and local conditions. So I do believe that the model we have today, where we have an operations component with the with considerable input coming in from the immediate programs and with the programs focusing on policy and procedures, is the model that we believe is the best model.
Thank you. We can go ahead.
VR&E performance. Well, some discussion on the in a later slide on the rehabilitation rate, but this is one of the key performance measures for this program. One of the things I'm going to ask Ms. Caden to discuss somewhat is that you'll see we take a jump up in our targets for 06 and 07. We've got some adjustment there to the baseline that we're measuring from, and in the interest of full disclosure, we'll talk about that so that there's no confusion about what the numbers actually represent. But again, we have been seeing more people rehabilitated through the program. We are seeing more veterans that are entering into the independent living status, so I will ask Judy to talk about that in further detail. We're taking a look at the speed of entitlement decisions. We're predicting improvement both in 06 and in 07 in this area, as we are expecting and predicting improvement in the accuracy of our decision making.
Okay, did you want me first? Sure. Let me address the rehabilitation rate. What we have done is redone the formula of how we're going to calculate the rehab rate. And we have added into the calculation something called the maximum rehabilitation rate and the gains. These are categories of veterans that have been participating in a VR&E program, but for several reasons have discontinued their participation. Many times they will accept an employment position that the counselor did not believe was consistent with their disability limitations, but through the work we have done with them, through the training they have gotten, some of the job services, they have accepted a position, and they're happy with it, and they've dropped out of the program. There's another category are those who are employable, but they have, for whatever reason, informed us that they are not going to seek employment. Things change in their personal life, and employment no longer is their goal at that time, and so they discontinue from the program. And then there are others who have worked through the program. They're not employed, and they're really not employable in our independent living program, and they may not finish the program, and usually that's because their medical disabilities interfere. And for physical reasons, they no longer participate in our program, but we have contributed to their increase in independent living. So what we have done with those three categories is neutralize them, if you will, from the calculation. We're not going to take a hit as a discontinued. We're not going to take the credit as a full rehabilitation achieved. but we will neutralize them, and that has caused the rate to jump to the current 69%. We just think that's a more fair view of the work that's being done.
In retrospectively, if we were to apply that same formulation to 2005, just for a apples-to-apples comparison, you would have seen the rehabilitation rate would have been 68.6%. This provides some of the timeliness statistics, as well as to give you an idea of the order of magnitude of the program participants. First of all, let me state that what you're seeing here is a snapshot in time. That's giving you the views of the status as of February the 1st of this year. And that applies both to the average days that have been in that status, as well as the number of veterans and service persons in those various stati. Are there any questions on that? This is something I know that there's been great interest in amongst the Congress, our status in implementing the VR&E task force recommendations. First of all, that we have actually completed over half of the recommendations of the of VR&E task force. There will be a few of those that at this point that we would not propose to implement, but we believe that we're making great progress on the remaining ones. The recommendation that we believe probably rises to the top is the implementation of the five-track employment model. That has successfully completed the, along with the jobs lab, successfully completed some of the pilot aspects, and we're in the process of nationwide implementation this year on this. And we're very pleased, and we believe that this is going to have a real positive impact upon the program operations on a national level. There's a study of veterans receiving independent living that our staff has undertaken. And we're also looking at the new employment coordinator position for trying to have national training for that particular position. There is a in the budget request, we have nearly $750,000 that's been requested for initiatives to support the program. If we can move on to the loan guarantee program. Loan guarantee highlights. This is one of, I believe, one of the department's success stories. And we don't always measure success by increasing resources. In this particular case, I believe that we can measure some success in the way that the program has been able to do more with less year after year. They've been making some great programmatic improvements. And I also believe that this is an area that's been a model for us to look at for successful consolidation, as well as for some successful integration of technology into their operations. And that they continue to make great strides in that regard. We can take a look at staffing. As you can see, staffing for this program is relatively flat, with a slight decline going into each year. We do not foresee any type of degradation of the key performance measures in the loan guarantee program through these types of adjustments.
If I might, before you go on, so in justifying this, the reduction of the FTE for this program, and you make reference, I think, in your written testimony, and I think you just did in terms of operational efficiencies that have been gained through information technology. I guess my first question is now, how do you know that the quality of service has remained high? And perhaps some of these other slides will show us that. And second, could you describe in a little bit more detail the technological advances the program has implemented to leverage such efficiencies?
Certainly, I'd be happy to. In fact, I'm going to ask Mr. Pedigo to respond more directly to you. But I can say that right now, Much of the staffing of the loan guarantee program is devoted in one form or another to oversight. And because, again, that we use so many, it's so intimately involved with, you know, with the commercial sector and in its dealings with, you know, with lenders and realtors, truly much of the, you know, much of the staffing there is involved in overseeing the performance of those particular programs. So, but with that, I'll pass it along to Mr. Pettigo.
Yes, Congresswoman, we have done a number of things to assure that we have a quality control system that provides a high level of oversight over the activities that are performed in the loan guarantee program. We have delegated a considerable amount of processing authority to the private sector. We have given lenders the authority to approve veterans' loans. We have given them the authority to make appraisal value determinations on VA's behalf. And in order to assure that they are properly carrying out our policies, we have several things in place. Internally, we have a statistical quality control system that measures every aspect of the work that our own staff perform. And for the last 3 years running, the overall quality index has been very high. We also have a lender monitoring unit, a staff of 13 auditors who go around primarily to the large lenders and perform on-site audits to make sure that they are properly carrying out VA's policies. And then finally, we have what we call a systematic analysis of operations, which is required to be performed once a year by each of our 9 regional loan centers, where they have to comprehensively review every aspect of their operations and submit the written report to the field station director as well as to central office. And those are the main mechanisms that we have in place to make sure that the quality remains at a high level. You also asked to talk about some of the information technology improvements that we've made that have enabled us to get the job done with fewer staff. We have made a concerted effort to try to provide as many self-service automated systems as we can, and the first effort in this area was in 2003 when we developed an automated certificate of eligibility system, which enabled a lending institution, whenever they had a veteran come in and apply for a loan, to go on the internet, access this system, and by putting the veteran's name, social security number, and date of birth in most cases get an instantaneous certificate of eligibility. That essentially has replaced a manual system that sometimes required 2 to 3 weeks for a veteran to get a certificate of eligibility. We also have a new automated appraisal system that we call TAS. And TAS does a number of things for us. Number one, it allows lending institutions to electronically order an appraisal report. Instead of having to send in paper documentation, as was previously the case, they can go on the internet, access the system, get the appraisal ordered, and at the same time get a case assignment number. The system also permits the appraisal report, once it is completed by the private sector appraiser, to be electronically sent to the lending institution and to the VA, eliminating anywhere from 3 to 5 days of mail time. Those are just some of the systems that we have put in place recently.
Ms. Brownlight.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. About a year ago, I had some complaints from realtors about the fact that they steer clients away from the VA loan guarantee because of there was a problem with the appraisers. That now, if I understood you correctly, you're saying that you allow the lenders to use their own appraisers, but don't they have to be on an approved list by you all? Is that accurate?
Yes, that is accurate. The change that we made with the automated system does not alter the requirement that VA controls who the appraiser will be on a veteran's real estate transaction. Lenders are now, however, able to access our automated system, and that automated system selects the appraiser based on a rotational selection process. So the lending institution has no control at all over who the appraiser will be. This is one of our oversight mechanisms.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chairman. Well, one of the problems has been that in some areas, the, quote, approved appraisers are limited. And so that's why the realtors have told me, excuse me, and the lenders, that they steer people away from the VA loans. Have you remedied that? Have you increased the list? Obviously, we want to make sure that they're not fly-by-night appraisers, but you also may need to look at the number that are available in certain areas.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we have taken some action in the last couple of years to address that problem. In October of 2003, we embarked upon a two-year marketing effort to increase the size of our appraisal roster by 40%. And when we completed this in October of 2005, we had accomplished our goal. So we now have roughly 1,600 more appraisers on our roster than we did back in October of 2003. So we believe that we have substantially addressed the problem where in some areas there were not sufficient appraisers. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't pockets where we still need some appraisers. And so we have directed our regional loan centers to continue seeking out new appraisers who would be interested in doing veterans appraisals.
Mr. Chairman, I want to thank the gentleman for taking the initiative to increase the number of appraisers, but I'm still told that there are areas where there is a shortfall, and I think you need to work toward that, because I'll tell you, I think veterans need to take advantage of this opportunity, especially now that we've increased the loan amount to be more reflective of real market values out there, and continuing to make sure that you have a good geographic representation. Not that, you know, a bank will give you a 30-day guarantee, a 30-day loan commitment, but if you can't get an appraiser who's approved by the VA, that's why there has been a reluctance to use this great program out there. And I certainly commend you for taking this initiative and encourage you to continue to look at areas where there is a shortfall.
We will definitely do that, Congresswoman.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Okay. Can you all comment on the cost of the Ocwen contract? And I guess there was some concern about them outsourcing, offshoring their call center.
Let me start off, and I'll pass along to my colleague, Mr. Pettigo. The Ocwen contract for property management, the outsourcing of that operation, has certainly been a challenge to our organization. And I believe that we're seeing improvements in the business relationship that we've had with Ocwen. But Admiral Cooper and I are very, very pleased with the way Mr. Pettigo has managed that. He's been holding their feet to the fire. Where we've been seeing any sorts of performance shortcomings on Ocwen's part. And I think there has been some fairly skillful contracting at work there that has the ability to impose penalties where we're not seeing performance. And we commend him for the business practices that were employed there. As far as the offshore thing, there's a little notoriety that was gained there. On this offshore component, it's true that Ocwen, we understand, does have some back office functions where they employ services from India. We understand they're largely in the accounting area. But as far as a call center goes, let me make it clear that no veteran is going to be placing a call that is referred to a call center, any offshore call center. This is largely within the industry. And I will defer to Mr. Pettigo on that issue, too, but I do believe that there should be no mistaking that no veterans or calls are being directed for any purpose to any offshore call center.
I would just expand a little bit on the cost issues. As Mr. Ahmed said, we do have a pretty aggressive oversight program in place. We set up a unit that is located in Nashville, Tennessee, where we have 19 auditors whose only job is to monitor the contract that we have with Ocwen Loan Servicing. and they review every payment voucher that is submitted by Ocwen, and there are thousands that are submitted each month. They also do field inspections of properties that Ocwen's property managers have inspected for us to make sure that they're doing adequate inspections. And they conduct quarterly audits of the Ocwen financial records to make sure that Ocwen is dealing with us in an even-handed manner. And so we do believe that we have a very good feel for how they are operating. And at the present time, we're in the process of trying to put pressure on them to improve in certain areas that we're not totally satisfied with. And we will continue to do that as we move forward. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned, and again, this is kind of off a little bit, but you mentioned the fact that, you know, through contracting and things, that you're trying to hold the, their feet to the fire. And I'm not suggesting that they've done anything wrong. We do have instances where people do things wrong, in just the size and the scope of the agency. Do you feel like there's sufficient law in place to give you the tools that you need, in dealing, and again, this doesn't have anything to do with them, but, when you run into situations where, do you have all the tools in the toolbox that you need to deal with people that you are having a tough time with, or people that blatantly aren't doing what they're supposed to do?
I would say I believe that we do. There's been some skillful contracting involved in establishing the Ocwen contract on that, and I believe that there are plenty of tools there and arrows in our quiver, I believe, to deal with this, which is not to say that we've not learned how the contracting to another iteration can be strengthened, because this was all rather novel to us. We had gone into this for the first time. So I think that we've found areas where we can have even tighter contracting in the future on that. But we do believe that the current repertoire of tools and remedies is probably adequate for our needs. Keith?
I would agree with that.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Over 150,000 loans guaranteed in 2005. Let me reiterate that this was something that was a little bit of an eye-opener to me when joining the Veterans Benefits Administration, and that really the real workload of our loan guarantee office is difficult to measure in the number of loans that are guaranteed, because that actually is something that is largely conducted within the private sector. So that's probably not the best measure of workload for us. Our workload is really more, as once again, in some of the oversight area, and the more direct services aspect of our workload consists of the staff that are out there helping veterans who eventually find themselves in loans that potentially are going bad. And I believe that is the direct services aspect of our work is better measured in the assistance that we provide veterans who are having difficulties, financial difficulties, in meeting their mortgages. The loan volume, we're predicting an uptick in 2006 and 2007. This is somewhat based upon the economic conditions, but Mr. Pedigo believes that while we had seen some increase in the past couple of years in some of the unusual financing type of loans, interest-only types of loans, that there's going to be more and more veterans in the future are going to be looking at some of the benefits of the more conventional type of loan offered by VA, such as the more conventional types of mortgages that we provide more of. And again, we're also looking at some of the workloads that are predicted, and that we've had some near historic lows in 2005 on the loans that are actually going into default. Mr. Pedigo can go into greater detail, but as he's described to me, that both VA and the industry in general tend to see that in the 3 to 6 year period that follows the placement of a new loan is the area where that many loans actually start to experience problems. And because we had to spike in some of our our loan business that corresponded with the historic lows in interest rates, we have more of our loans that are now entering into that riskier period of time. So it's our expectation that there could be some workload increase to be expected in 2006 and 2007 because of that. Our loan guarantee performance, we've have this the one performance factor that we've relied upon for the last several years, the so-called FATS ratio, which is the foreclosure avoidance through servicing. That's a measure, again, of the loans that we're able to help salvage and repair and putting making sure that we keep veterans from their homes going fully into foreclosure. We're predicting a little bit of a downtick in that for 2006 and 2007 for the very reason I was describing, in that there is some expectation that there will be a higher percentage of loans encountering difficulties during that period of time. Statistical quality index, I believe Mr. Pedigo addressed that earlier when he was discussing some of the oversight and quality control measures that we have in place. One of the things I'd like to just discuss before we move on to the next slide, it's sort of in anticipation of the next slide, is that we have a new system that's going to be going in place, a new initiative. It's called the VA Loan Electronic Reporting Interface. The acronym is VALERI. We believe that some of the new capability that provides us through that moving towards that sort of a system is going to allow us to move towards some new types of performance measures in future years. We don't have those just yet, but I know many of us internally have been dissatisfied with the FATS ratio as our sole measure of performance for the loan guarantee program. The loan guarantee program themselves feel that way, and we believe that when this new system is in place, we will have greater options for developing what we believe are going to be very meaningful performance measures for the program, and we're very much looking forward to that. Lisa. Lastly, I'd like to the one initiative that we have on the table today for the loan guarantee program is this VA loan electronic reporting interface, which is not strictly a technology initiative as much as it is a business initiative. I'm going to allow Mr. Pedigo to go into greater detail on it, but this is part of our overall loan application redesign process, and that involves some rulemaking that was completed last year, and this is the system that helps complement some of the changes that were made through the rulemaking procedure. But Heath?
We've been assisting veterans who encounter financial difficulty for many years, and this is the part of the loan guarantee program that requires the most hands-on treatment of veterans. For example, last year we made 301,000 phone calls to veterans whose loans were seriously delinquent. And during those calls, we offered financial counseling, we gathered information on the veteran's financial situation, and in many cases interceded on the veteran's behalf with the lender, set up a repayment plan that last year resulted in almost 9,000 loans that were destined for foreclosure being brought current. We've been using the same policies and the same system for the last 8 years to administer this part of the program. 4 years ago, we decided it was time to take a comprehensive look at this process to see if there were ways that we could do things better. And so we embarked in a formal business process reengineering initiative that resulted in a totally new way of doing business. And that new way of doing business is included in the 96-page set of regulations that we expect to finalize very shortly. When we developed these new policies, we also decided that we needed to develop a new automated system to overlay the new policies, a system that would enable us to do a better job of serving veterans who encounter financial difficulty. That's the VALERI system that Mr. Ahmet referred to. And at the present time, we are working with Fidelity National Financial, which is a very large company headquartered in Jacksonville, Florida, a company that has an automated system that serves over 50% of the private sector servicing industry. And we have asked them to take their present servicing platform, build some VA-specific interfaces, and then allow us to pay them a service fee once that system is completed, an annual service fee in order to utilize this system. The system will give us the ability to get involved with a delinquent borrower's loan at the 31st day of delinquency. Presently, we do not get involved until the 90th day of the delinquency. It will also permit us to move electronically the workload that we have at any of our 9 regional loan centers to another regional loan center virtually overnight. It will give us the ability to have almost real-time access to private servicers' databases. Presently, we have no access. The only information we get on how the servicer has handled a veteran's loan is when they send in a paper copy record of how they have serviced that loan. So with this new system, we'll be able to go in when we know a veteran's loan is delinquent, look at how the servicer has handled that loan, and then determine whether we need to get involved to supplement the servicing on that veteran's loan. So our expectation is that in March of 07, we will have the finalized regulations, we will have the system ready to roll out, and we will be able to begin operating in this new and better environment.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, just to wrap this section up, I appreciate the overview as well as Mr. Pettigrew, what you just explained that will allow all of you to get involved earlier to, again, advocate on behalf of the veterans and proactively find ways to bring those loans current by getting involved much earlier in the process. My last question just relates to the ongoing challenges we face in the Gulf region, and can you provide an update for us on VA's efforts to support the federal government providing housing assistance to the folks in Louisiana and the whole Gulf Coast who may have lost their homes due to Hurricane Katrina who may be eligible as veterans for these programs?
Yeah, I'd be happy to start that off and pass along to Mr. Pettigrew. As you're probably aware, we've become involved very early in the process when the federal government was trying to work its way through, seeing how we could help provide housing to displaced persons in the Gulf region. We had, VA had been part of a group that had been formed, headed up by the White House, that included FEMA and three federal agencies involved in housing. That would be HUD, Department of Agriculture, and VA. We had to quickly take some inventories of what some of our available housing stocks were, and we'd been reporting on those immediately to the groups that were spearheading this effort. I guess we were very sympathetic to FEMA at this time. We realized that when we had taken a look at what type of housing we had available that was considered to be habitable housing, that would mean that it's ready move-in condition for families. In some cases, some of the housing that we have that we actually own, there are still veterans or other borrowers that are residing in those in that housing under adverse possession. They've still not yet been moved. But we had probably under 1,000 single-family dwelling housing units that were available in the 11-state area that constituted the area of demarcation. And we know that FEMA was confronted with the challenge of finding housing for hundreds of thousands of people as opposed to, we had housing for maybe hundreds. And so I think that initially they were looking at larger scale housing challenges. Since then we've actually finalized a memorandum of agreement with FEMA. We had a memorandum of agreement that went back into the 1980s. That we've been operating under that had really grown very stale and was not really reflective of today's conditions. That was refreshed and that was signed back in December. And in the meantime, we continued to work with Ocwen, the property management contractor, to be looking at ways that, we could make the housing available and trying to look at some of the back office processes and procedures that we would need to actually execute against the decision to start placing people in housing. And we're happy to be able to report that just over the past couple of weeks, I believe last week, we had signed the first lease with someone for a VA property that was in the San Antonio, Texas area, where we had a 100% disabled female veteran that we were actually able to place in one of the VA properties in San Antonio. And in fact, we've been able to, assist her actually with some of the minor adaptations to the housing through the program, I believe it's the HISA program that's managed under the VA's prosthetics program to provide some minor adaptations. Just asking Keith on the ride over here this morning about some others. How many additional ones have you said?
61.
Around 61 additional leases that have been signed. So we're maybe a little bit slow starting on this, but we're happy to report that we're being able to put our excess housing to good use, to leasing to these individuals who are in need of housing. One of the things that we've insisted upon was to be able to provide some level of veterans preference here, so that if you had certainly more than a single interested evacuee in any particular VA property, we would try and provide preference to any one of those who was either a veteran or had a veteran family member.
Just a couple things real quickly, and then we'll get you guys out of here. But how much does the VA collect in loan guarantee funding fees? If you don't have it, you can send it over.
Over the last four fiscal years, full fiscal years, we've collected just a bit over $2 billion. That's billion with a B,
okay.
Dollars.
Very good. One other thing, and this goes back to the Voc Rehab. The Legion and others have recommended training the Voc Rehab staff at the National Veterans Training Institute. Can you comment on that? Do you have a comment about that? Do you think that's something that would be beneficial?
I'm going to ask Ms. Caden to a remark on that. We do use that as a training source for certain targeted staff members in our VRE program, but I'll let her elaborate.
Yeah, thank you. We've been using NVTI, the National Veterans Training Institute, in a couple of different ways. In fact, we just completed our own training session using their facility last week for the employment coordinators and in helping us roll out the five-track training. And as Mr. Ahmet mentioned, we do send employment coordinators or in the past employment specialists and some counselors to NVTI for specific training in job placement abilities and also case management. And we've also, under our new memorandum of agreement with DOL, have a work group that is specifically looking at joint training and how we can make that better using that facility.
Much. Scott, we don't want you to get out of here without one last thing. The budget shows that VA met its statutory 3% goal for disabled veteran-owned small business in fiscal year 05. That differs from some of the interim data we've heard over the past several months. Can you comment on that?
Sure, be happy to. Actually, that was a typo. That was an error. Our trends, though, I'm happy to report, are going upward. In 2003, we had 0.4% to service disabled vet. That was in 2003. 2004, we were 1.2, and last year in 2005, we were 2.1% towards the 3% statutory goal. So we're going in the right direction. We have what we believe is a very executive strategic plan required by the executive order, and we fully expect to be able to report to you that we'll make the 3% goal in 2006.
Do you have any other things? I want to thank the panel. I think this has been very informative, and I've learned a lot. And so, again, we really do appreciate you and appreciate you being so forthcoming. And we look forward to working with you, this year. We've got lots of challenges. But I think the good news is we're moving in the right direction. So, again, thank you for your hard work.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Congresswoman.
Okay, let's have our next panel, if you would. Today, we're very pleased to have as our second panel Mr. Joe Sharp, Deputy Director of Economics for the American Legion, and Ms. Joy Elam, Assistant National Legislative Director, who will represent the authors of the independent budget. Welcome, and let's begin with Ms. Elam.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon to you and members of the subcommittee. I'm pleased to appear before you on behalf of the disabled American veterans to comment on the recommendations of the 2007 independent budget and the President's proposed fiscal year 2007 budget for the programs under consideration today. My statement highlights some of our recommendations for ways to improve education, vocational rehabilitation, home loan, and specially adapted housing grant programs. Along with recommendations, we include staffing levels, recommended staffing levels to administer the respective programs. Education benefits provided to veterans have served them well throughout generations. History illustrates that when our veterans have educational opportunities, the entire nation benefits. Following World War II, veterans using the GI Bill became a catalyst in the economic and social development of our country. Today's veterans carry the same potential, and we should grant them the highest level of resources possible to reward them for their service and to ensure our nation's economic vitality. To improve education benefits, the IB makes the following recommendations to Congress. Remove the restriction on eligibility for the Montgomery GI Bill for those who first entered the service after June 30, 1985. Change the law to permit refund of an individual's Montgomery GI Bill contributions when his or her discharge was characterized as general or under honorable conditions because of minor infractions, and make education benefits more equitable for National Guard and reservists. The Vocational Rehabilitation and Education Program is responsible for providing services and assistance to service-connected disabled veterans that will enable them to obtain and maintain stable, gainful employment. By helping disabled veterans help themselves, we not only serve them, we serve a nation as a whole. Like the Montgomery GI Bill, vocational rehabilitation and education services also have a direct impact on the country's economic and social development. To improve these benefits, the IB makes the following recommendations. VR&E should develop plans and partnerships to enhance entrepreneurial opportunities for disabled veterans. Monitor the progress of disabled veterans for at least 2 years to ensure rehabilitation is successful. Reduce the caseload for managers from the current 145 to 100 cases per counselor to allow closer monitoring of progress, and employ a results-based criteria to evaluate and improve services. We view adequate staffing levels as essential to an efficient benefits delivery system that is necessary for VA to fulfill its mission. We recommend an increase of 149 FTE for education service than authorized for fiscal year 06 for a total of 1,033 FTE. We recommend an increase of 250 FTE for voc rehab over last year for a total of 1,375 FTE. Another recommendation by the IB concerns the specially adapted housing program. Veterans who are entitled to compensation for certain permanent and total service-connected disabilities are eligible for a grant to adapt their homes with fixtures made necessary by the nature of their disabilities. The specially adapted housing program provides 50% of the cost of an adapted home. Veterans who have sacrificed so dearly in the name of freedom have earned any measure we can provide to make their lives as normal as possible. This program is intended for this purpose. To improve the specially adapted housing benefits, the IB makes the following recommendations. Congress should increase specially adapted housing grants and provide for future automatic adjustments indexed to the rise in the cost of living. Additionally, Congress should establish a grant to cover the cost of home adaptation for veterans who replace their specially adapted homes with new housing. With regard to loan guarantee, the IB has just one recommendation. Congress should refrain from increasing home loan fees and should, as soon as possible, repeal fees such fees entirely. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my statement. I'm happy to answer any questions you or members of the subcommittee may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sharp.
Mr. Chairman and members of the subcommittee, we appreciate this opportunity to share the views of the American Legion on the VA's fiscal year 2007 budget requests for the education, loan guarantee, and the vocational rehabilitation employment programs. The mission of the VR&E program is to help qualified service disabled veterans achieve independence in daily living and to maximize, and to their maximum extent feasible, obtain and maintain suitable employment. The American Legion fully supports these goals. Therefore, the American Legion supports the Veterans Benefit Administration's recommendation that $149 million is needed to fund the discretionary portion of the Vocational Rehabilitation and Employment Program in 2007. Additional FTE requirements, along with an expected 2.5 increased workload of veterans expected to use the program services, thus requiring additional funding. The Veterans Home Loan Guarantee Program has been in effect since 1944 and has afforded approximately 17 million veterans the opportunity to purchase homes. The Home Loan Program has been so successful over the past few years that it is one of the only federal programs turning a profit. Therefore, the American Legion recommends that a cost savings should be passed on to the veterans in the form of a reduction in funding fees, which can add approximately $8,000 to $13,000 for a first or second-time buyer. The American Legion strongly recommends that the VA funding fee on home loans be reduced or eliminated for all veterans, whether active duty, reservists, or National Guard. The American Legion recommends a discretionary funding level of $127.2 million for the VA home loan program. In the 20 years since the Montgomery GI Bill went into effect on June 30, 1985, the nation's security has changed radically from a fixed Cold War to a dynamic global war on terror. In 1991, the active duty force of the military stood at 2.1 million. Today, it stands at 1.4 million. Between 1915 and 1990, the reserve force was involuntarily mobilized only 9 times. Since 9/11, more than 480,000 members of the 860,000 member selected reserve have been activated. Today, approximately 40% of troops in Iraq are guardsmen reservists. As the distinctions between the active and reserve forces continues to diminish, the difference between the active and reserve forces of the GI Bill should decline accordingly. Therefore, the American Legion recommends updating the GI Bill to accept the new security realities of the open-ended global war on terror, the recruiting retention issues which arise from it, and the expanded role that the reserve forces play in the modern era. The American Legion supports and has a history of advocating increasing educating benefits to members of our armed forces. The American Legion supports recommendations by the Veterans Benefit Administration for a funding level of $92.3 million to fund the discretionary portion of the education program of 2007. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my testimony. I appreciate the opportunity to present the American Legion's views on these important and timely topics.
Thank you. Ms. Herseth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have any questions, just a couple of comments, and certainly appreciate both of you being here today and your testimony in support of the independent budget, the work that your organizations do that you're here to represent today on behalf of our nation's veterans. Just a couple of comments with regard to the housing adaptation grants. I do intend to introduce legislation in the upcoming weeks to do precisely what you've recommended as a representative of the DAV that reflects sort of the increased amounts to make these adaptations to various homes for our veterans, and certainly we hope to get good bipartisan support for that bill. And then, Mr. Sharp, I do appreciate, I like this idea of when we, number of us have commented in the past, as I did even with the making permanent pilot program for Native American veterans and their housing, that this is an area where there is a profit. It's paying for itself. And so I find your idea interesting to take that and meet the objective that Ms. Isla mentioned of reducing these fees to veterans over time within that program is also the recognition of the importance of the education programs, the timeliness and effectiveness of those benefits to our veterans as a recruitment and retention tool in our armed forces, active duty as well as Guard and Reserve. So thank you again very much and again for the work that you've put into the independent budget.
Yes, I would like to join Ms. Herseth in again complimenting you on the a great deal of work that was put into the budget. We do appreciate your testimony. And as you know, the next few days are going to be really very busy. We've got our views and estimates for the budget committee. We're going to have the next couple of days. I think the chairman will present his views and estimates to the full committee at a business meeting following Thursday's hearing, and the final document go to the budget committee not later than the 23rd. So, you know, what we've heard from you, what we've heard from the administration really is very, very helpful. So thank you for your testimony. Let me just ask you a couple things. We've talked about the total force GI bill. Would you explain the concept behind revamping veterans' education benefits in that regard, as you see it?
Okay. I would just refer you. We did do a section in the independent budget on the GI Bill and the revamping of that program entitled Matching Education Benefits to the Service Performed, 21st Century Montgomery GI Bill. And basically, it offers a three-tier approach to the program, with the first being to those similar current under the Montgomery GI Bill for active duty, three-year rate, and addressing those folks in the active armed forces. The second tier recommended would be for non-prior service direct entry into the select reserves, and the benefit being more proportional to the active duty rate. Then a third tier would be for members of the ready reserves who are activated for at least 90 days, and they'd receive, the recommendation was that they would receive 1 month of benefits for each month of activation up to a total of 36 months at the active duty rate. And the overall recommendation was just that Congress should combine all the active duty and reserve Montgomery GI Bill programs and tier benefits according to the service performed, just to make it more equitable benefit.
And the Legion feels that, again, with the new realities, that it's a better program, and it would help retention if we did something to enhance the education benefits, not only for the reserves, but also active duty. As you know, for a reservist that is activated, they're generally paid $297 a month, regardless if they go to Iraq or not. And we just feel that those individuals who are on active duty, who are in Iraq and Afghanistan, who are also paying the price as same as the active duty individual, that they should get some sort of increase in the educational benefit. We just think it's a fair thing to do. Also, with the total force bill, with everything put under one house, probably the VA, we just think it's much more efficient. Right now, it takes 2 or 3 months for an individual to get their education benefits. And as was mentioned earlier, my own reserve unit, we have individuals waiting 3 and 4 months to get their check from the VA. And of course, this causes a great deal of hardship on these individuals. They're usually young, they're usually married, you know, they have families, and to be forced to try and pay this bill out of pocket and then wait for payment later is just not a right thing to do. And I know the VA has been trying to augment their services with additional FTE, trying to automate. It's still a time-consuming situation, and I think the total force GI bill would go a long way to help reduce, you know, the current situation.
Very good. Thank you. One final thing. Would you explain the independent budget's position on empowering the business line directors?
I'm sorry.
Would you explain the independent budget position on empowering the business line directors?
Empowering the business line directors. I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to answer that. I certainly can ask someone that has expert budget, on this subject matter, though, to relay the question and have you, them do it.
Yes, ma'am, that would be fine. We'll do that for the record then.
Okay.
And that would be great. So, again, that's all I've got. Have you got any other things, Ms. Herseth? Well, thank you all again very much for your help. We certainly appreciate the input, the hard work that goes into the independent budget, and we thank you for your service and all that you all represent. The meeting stands adjourned.
Thank you.